Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
From Washington, this is the CQ Budget Podcast, your leading Capitol Hill source on how Congress allocates federal taxpayer dollars.
Welcome back to the CQ Budget Podcast. I'm David Lerman, your budget tracker. Lawmakers are now home campaigning for re-election, but they bought themselves some extra time for appropriations by finally passing a stopgap funding measure to extend current funding levels into mid-December. It was a chaotic close to the September session, and joining me to talk about all of it is Peter Cohn, the tax and budget editor at CQ Roll Call. Thanks again for being here, Pete.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
So it's always kind of a surprise to me how much of a struggle it is to get these simple stopgap continuing resolutions across the finish line. And this was no exception. It went dragged on to the very last day they had under the deadline to get this done. There always seems to be some big thing holding it up. This year, of course, it was Joe Manchin's effort to streamline permitting for energy projects. You can never quite predict what'll get attached to these things that hold it up. And they finally caved on that, and that sort of cleared the way for this bill to get through. But it still wasn't easy, and it cleared the Senate, it cleared the House on Friday in their scramble to rush home on pretty much a party line vote. Even these simple stopgaps have become these polarizing measures. Never mind that you don't have regular appropriations yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, keep in mind that this is the last piece of legislation that's going to move before the elections. So anytime you have, this is a must-pass bill. If you don't pass it, federal agencies have to start winding down their operations within a day or two. So, that means furloughs for thousands of workers, in a time when we're likely potentially headed for a recession. So none of that would be good. And both sides recognize that. So the question is, everybody knows it's going to pass. So it's everybody's jockeying for advantage at the right up until the deadline, right? So it becomes a question of what can we add to the bill and still pass it and still get 60 votes in the Senate and 218 in the House. And so this happens every time. And so, a couple of years ago, they were arguing over, the Trump administration wanted to put more money, wanted to pay off farmers because of the pressure they were taking on prices from the Chinese import embargo, right? And things like that. And so the Democrats said, well, if you're going to get that for farmers who are going to vote for you for reelection, we need to get money for nutrition programs in the CR. So you see what I mean? It's just these kinds of things always happen, and they always drag the deadline right up until the last minute. Because why not? If you have time to try to jam something into a must-pass bill, why wouldn't you take that opportunity, right? So that's where we are. And actually, this one, we had several during the Trump administration where they passed, late at night or went even over the deadline. Of course, we had a 35-day government shutdown during the Trump administration too. But we had bills, Trump was signing them at, 1 a.m., even after the technical deadline passed. So this one was actually fairly orderly, if you think about it.
So I guess we should be grateful that they finished like during normal work hours. Apart from just continuing the current funding levels, they did put in some emergency spending, and there was broad bipartisan support for including an extra $12 billion for Ukraine. That seemed non-controversial, and we're going to see, I think, continued requests for more Ukraine funding in coming months. But missing from this package was this effort to provide more money for the COVID-19 pandemic or monkeypox. And healthcare spending seems to be a partisan divide now, where Republicans just don't see the need for more money. They think they can just tap unspent money from previous pandemic laws. And so this, we're still going to see a battle over this in coming months, it sounds like.
Yeah, there was always a strong likelihood that there was going to be some kind of an emergency funding package attached to this bill. That's almost become a pattern too. Yeah, last year there was a big disaster aid package and some other things that were attached to the CR they needed to pass at the end of last September. So obviously with the Ukraine conflict grinding on and you know, a lot of concern about what Putin's going to do next, and with the obviously the devastating hurricanes in Puerto Rico and Florida over the last couple of days, there was always a strong likelihood that there was going to be additional money. Now, the CR automatically unlocks about $19 billion for FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. So that was a big driving force in getting bipartisan support for this bill as well. Although, of course, the Florida senators either voted no or were absent from the vote. But, you know, there are a lot of other things in the bill that a lot of conservatives didn't like. So it's one of those things where, you know, you're able to vote no, but hope yes. That's kind of the slogan. So, you know, it got done, and people who didn't, there were things in it they didn't like, got to vote against it because there were plenty of other people to vote for it.
I guess what we still don't know, Pete, is, you know, the Florida senators have already asked for a supplemental funding bill for hurricane relief, even though, as you point out, this pumps a lot more money into the disaster relief fund. So they're sitting on a good pile of cash right now in that fund. But we still don't really know what the damage assessment is going to show in Florida and whether they will, in fact, need supplemental funding. I mean, some of these towns were completely wiped out. It sounds like it's conceivable that a supplemental bill could still be needed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. There's going to be a pretty high price tag associated with rebuilding after these storms. And so we'll probably see that in the lame duck, whether it's standalone or part of the omnibus spending bill. Remains to be seen, but FEMA's got about $35 billion now, which is going to take care of most of the immediate needs as a result of these storms and some other things they were already obligated to do. But you know, FEMA's for immediate needs, and you know, the longer term rebuilding, you know, getting people's houses rebuilt, getting roads fixed, things like that. All the any government facilities that were damaged, whether it's, you know, Department of Defense or NASA, things like that. Money to compensate agricultural producers, crop producers for everything they lost. You know, these things, Army Corps of Engineers, you know, obviously helping them to mitigate future disasters like this and rebuild the, you know, things that broke this time. There's going to be this happens every time. And so they'll come back in the lame duck, and maybe even into next year, there'll be a need for more. We'll see what the Republican appetite is then, but you know, you certainly, as we just discussed, there's certainly support on the Republican side of the aisle from some pretty conservative guys to pump more money into this rebuilding effort.
And there was already some criticism I heard over the weekend of, you know, some of the political posturing where Democrats say, how come, you know, some of you Republicans voted against Superstorm Sandy money, and now you're coming to us wanting Florida money? Isn't that hypocritical? There's already some of that backbiting going on. I suspect, you know, they won't come back till after the elections. The political pressures will simmer, they'll lower, and there would be bipartisan support for an emergency package, assuming they can document the need and based on what the damage assessments show.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is a very familiar pattern here. I mean, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas was kind of the face of the opposition to Hurricane Sandy relief way back in 2012, 2013. And, you know, 4 years later, when Hurricane Harvey just demolished Houston, Senator Ted Cruz was one of the people advocating for relief. So, you know, this happens all the time. If there's a disaster in another part of the country that seems remote to you and you don't like government spending, you're going to complain about it. But then when it hits home, you're going to see how important it is.
Right. That's what happened with Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, over the weekend, where he was being criticized for having voted against the Superstorm Sandy money. And he said there was too much pork in that. but he supports the general concept of emergency relief and wasn't seeking for it to be offset. He just didn't want pork projects in there, or what he viewed as pork projects. So he was trying to defend himself from that, even as he prepares now to have to request probably a lot more money out of the feds.
Yeah, David, you know, like, as you and I both know, there's a long history of people being for something before they're against it, or vice versa. And there's one word that to explain that, and it's called politics. And so there's no surprise, and there's a long, illustrious history of people on both sides of the aisle being for something before they're against it, or vice versa. So that's where we are.
Let's just look ahead a minute, Pete, to what we're facing in December. Obviously, this CR money ties them over to mid-December, when they're expecting to pass a final package for the this new fiscal year that just began on Saturday, in one big omnibus package. Same fight as last year over how much for defense spending versus non-defense. It's going to be that same battle, it looks like. And I noticed that the Richard Shelby, the top Senate appropriator, Republican, just said that this year, there's this Republican push for so-called parity, equal increases in defense and non-defense spending, may not even be good enough anymore. He's saying there needs to be more for defense than non-defense. We're seeing them raise the stakes here for the next showdown.
Yeah, I think, look what happened last year. That's a very good model for what's going to happen this time around. They ended up with, everyone said, you know, the National Defense Authorization Act, the policy bill that kind of becomes a framework for what they eventually do on appropriations. That was much higher than what the Democrats in the House wanted to see, and what the Biden administration wanted to see on defense spending. So they ended up going actually even higher than the NDAA authorized levels in the end, partly thanks to people like Richard Shelby, who are really pushing to get that number up. So Shelby's on his way out. He's retiring at the end of this year. I have no doubt that, you know, somebody told me a long time ago, when I was at another publication, that Richard Shelby usually gets what he wants. And, you know, that was a long time ago, and he's still there. He's on his way out the door, but he probably will once again get what he wants.
And he does. He does want an omnibus deal, as opposed to pushing it, punting it into the new year.
Yeah, half the Senate Republicans want to get this done, and so that's enough. That's enough to get you over the hump, the 60 votes. So, and you know, again, I think there's a lot of hope yes, vote no people, you know, on the House Republican side who want to get this out of the way. They want to get their earmarks in the final bill, and because we don't know what's going to happen with earmarks next year if the House flips. So there's a lot of people who want to get this done. They just would like to vote against it because it is politically expedient for them to be able to vote against it. You're going to see with defense and non-defense, we're going to see basically a repeat of what happened last year. They're going to get, you know, those numbers are going to move a lot closer to each other than they are currently in the House bills. Even in the Senate bills, they're not quite where the Republicans want to see them. But I think, you know, that what we really saw emerge on the House floor during that debate on Friday was border issues are really going to come up in the, they came up during this debate in immigration policies, but, you know, again, they were able to kind of massage those, but that's going to come up again in the omnibus talks. You know, they had $1.8 billion for the Office of Refugee Resettlement at HHS, which basically takes care of people who are awaiting processing, who've come over the border, you know, food, shelter, medical care, and things like that. And I mean, this is one of the things House Republicans at least highlighted, which is that, look, we got we've got this unprecedented influx of people coming over the border. We're not doing anything about that, but instead we're just shelling out money to help take care of them.
And that was one of their key arguments for voting against this continuing resolution, was that little provision on the
health. There's this sense that you know, Democratic on the Republican side, the Democratic policies are sort of exacerbating some of these problems, whether it's inflation with things that passed in the what they call the Inflation Reduction Act, because, you know, there's a lot of benefits going out the door, and Republicans don't like throwing money at people basically to paper over issues like that. So they, you know, they voted, they don't like the fact that the CR gave $1 billion to LIHEAP, Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, because they said, look, you know, heating bills are going up partly because, now this may or may not be true, but the argument is Democrats passed a new tax, a new fee on methane emissions in the Reconciliation Act at a time when natural gas prices are already rising, you know, pretty substantially. So there's this sense that, like, look, we're making problems worse on, you know, Democratic policy. This is a Republican point of view, I'm just saying. Democrats are making some of these issues worse, and then they're just trying to throw money at it to paper it over. So whether it's with inflation, whether it's with immigration, things like that, that's kind of a theme that emerged in this debate and it had been emerging for some time. And we're going to see that with some of these add-ons that they want to put into the omnibus in December as well.
Okay. And the other thing they did, Pete, before leaving for this recess, kind of hit by surprise, really, was this last-minute legislation designed to help families of the September 11 terrorist attacks. Sort of came out of the blue, but the House rushed through this bill, much to the consternation of most Republicans who said they hadn't been consulted and just kind of sideswiped by it.
Yeah, except they all voted for it anyway.
it passed overwhelmingly, I was going to say, with like 400 votes in the House, which is a rare occurrence. And it's kind of complicated, but this would provide maybe up to $3 billion of additional payments for spouses and children of 9/11 families out of a fund that was never supposed to be for 9/11 families. It's this complicated ordeal where they created this fund for state-sponsored terrorism. This was a fund really designed to help the people held hostage by Iran back in the 70s. And other victims of state-sponsored terrorism. And what you had a few years ago, all of a sudden, the 9/11 families got access to this fund, even though they had their own fund. And so there's been this incredible headache now that really goes unseen by the public. But there's actually a tug of war between families of Iran hostages and families of 9/11 now, competing for this fund of state-sponsored terrorism because there's not really enough money in there to pay everyone now. Congress tried to address this with an additional payment.
Yeah, David, you know, this didn't come, you said this came out of the blue, but no, it didn't, as you later pointed out, this didn't come out of the blue. In fact, I mean, you wrote a great article about this a couple of years ago when it was first kind of becoming an issue, and it was very much under the radar at the time. And as we saw, it just kind of burst out into the open over the last couple of days, right? I mean,
well, that's what I mean is that
I know what you're saying, but what I'm saying is this has been building for a long time, and and you know, it was very interesting. We still haven't really gotten much of an explanation as to why. I mean, maybe it's because they couldn't pass the Stock Act, you know, the insider trading ban for lawmakers and their spouses. So they needed to go out with it with some kind of a win before the recess. And so, you know, that's maybe what happened there. But I mean, the whole thing was just fascinating how this bill came up. And it's also interesting that they chose to put this one out there instead of backfilling the World Trade Center Health Fund, which has been where a lot of the public pressure, I'd say more public pressure, has been on Congress to try to fix that. Otherwise, that's going to stop being able to accept new recipients, I think, in what, late 2024. Now, you could argue that that's got more of a runway before Congress has to deal with that.
But that one is facing a shortfall. I mean, that has to deal with paying medical claims for people suffering the health effects when the Twin Towers collapsed in New York.
Right. Which you could, you know, and so I don't know, maybe it's the P word, the word politics, because you had a lot of Republican supporters pushing for action on that bill as well. And I don't know. I mean, the cost is the same. They're both $3 billion. And they used an offset in the 9/11 compensation bill, which is separate again from the World Trade Center health funding bill. They used an offset that now they're not going to be able to use when they get to the health funding issue, which, and Nancy Pelosi said they want to take that up in the lame duck as well. So, I don't know.
The interesting thing to me, Pete, on this is 9/11 families can now tap a fund that wasn't designed for them based on what most people consider to be a pretty bogus court ruling that Iran was somehow responsible for 9/11. And that's how they drew the connection between a state-sponsored fund and the 9/11 horror.
I think everybody should read your article from, after this podcast post, we'll put a link to in the newsletter that we link to the podcast in. We're going to put a link to David's article. I think everybody, all listeners of the CQ Budget podcast should go back and read that article from January 2020, which lays it out in detail, which is the fact that there was this court ruling that opened the door to a fund that was for victims of state-sponsored terrorism, like the hostages in Iran. They said, hey, all of a sudden Iran is liable for 9/11 as well. So it got the 9/11 family members that weren't able to get compensated the first time in the first compensation fund after 9/11, because there are some rules against parents and siblings and things like that. So all the parents and siblings rush in, and then all of a sudden there's not enough money left in this fund. And the fund's supposed to be financed by fines and penalties on sanctions violators. And there haven't been enough sanctions violations. So all of a sudden they need money. And so you've got people like Thomas Massey, Republican from Kentucky, and other critics of this bill who are saying, well, look, a lot of people think Saudi Arabia was liable for 9/11. Why don't we add them to the list? And we can get billions of dollars more from, sanctions violators doing business with Saudi Arabia. So it's a fascinating. And then, of course, the whole political aspect of it with the lead sponsor of this bill, Nicole Malliotakis from Staten Island, from New York, who flipped the Democratic district in 2020. She's a Republican, yes, and she's running against the same guy this year. She was the lead sponsor of that bill. And Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, wasn't even a sponsor of that bill. He just comes out, introduces his own version of it. It's literally the identical language, other than he included a pay for in it, which is great. You know, they needed a pay for, but Jerry Nadler includes a pay for. And then all of a sudden it's Jerry Nadler's bill and he's the lead sponsor of it and he's managing it on the floor. I mean, he would have anyway, because he's chairman of Judiciary, but
the so power of being in the majority,
the
I guess
power of,
Nadler's
of
a Democrat and
being
he
a chairman.
Able to take it over.
Yeah. And so, you know, the Republican doesn't get as much credit who's in a tough race, but you know, then she had this great line on the floor, Malliotakis. So she said, look, I'm going to just invoke Harry Truman here, where it doesn't matter who gets the credit as long as something good, you know, happens at the end. So it was just a really kind of unsung story at the end of last week. And David, you know, my hat's off to you for really kind of shining a light on this a couple of years ago when this first emerged.
Well, it's a fascinating case because this judge tried to claim that Iran is responsible for 9/11. And what was striking to me in talking to lawmakers, Pete, is almost nobody believes that. And they won't comment, they won't endorse the court ruling, but they just sort of accept it as fact and then proceed to craft this law, which gives 9/11 families access to this fund for Iran hostages. It's the most twisted, perverse thing to put more financial pressure on a fund that was never supposed to serve 9/11, because the 9/11 folks had their own fund. Now they're coming into this state-sponsored fund. And it's created a lot more problems and a lot more headaches than I think lawmakers anticipated, as we just saw last week with the need to shore it up yet again with additional money. So, and yet at the same time, lawmakers can't vote against it because it looks like you're coming out against 9/11 victims if you vote against it. It would be politically deadly to oppose. So it passes overwhelmingly. And no, you know, everybody has sympathy for the 9/11 families. That's not the argument. And so that's the situation they were in. And so they blew it through the House. We're going to have to see now if it actually, what the Senate does with it, because the Senate hasn't acted. They're now in recess. They won't come back till the lame duck session. And we'll have to see if the Senate takes it up and how they handle it.
Yeah, if I had a guess, they'll roll it into the omnibus and they'll deal with it as some sort of a broader negotiation involving the World Trade Center Health Fund as well. That'd be my guess. And we'll see, you know, they have to figure out offsets. Yeah, it's got a lot of support. I mean, you know, there's going to be plenty of support for it in the Senate too. And, you know, in your article, David, from a couple of years ago, Lindsey Graham, one of the architects of the original legislation that cracked open the door to more of these 9/11 families getting access to this fund. I remember you asked him, you interviewed him and said, Senator Graham, do you think Iran was liable in this? And he said, well, not particularly, but we're going to just do this anyway. Because I mean, the 9/11 families are so politically potent. And it's just, you know, how do you say to the children, the spouses of these people who, you know, watched the towers demolished on 9/11, how do you ultimately say to them, you don't deserve this additional funding? You know, you say, oh, you got money 20 years ago, so you shouldn't get any money now. It's just a tough argument to make, you know, for those people, even though things are, you know, maybe it's not as working as it was intended initially. I mean, you know, 9/11 right. Commission said Iran's not responsible.
Yeah, Graham said he didn't really buy the court ruling, but he considered it a form of rough justice
Justice, exactly. That's what this is. This is rough justice. David, and you were on top of this from the very beginning. And I encourage everybody to read that article. And we'll make it widely available.
We'll see what the Senate does with this, if anything. But that's all the time we have for now. Thank you again, Peter Cohn, tax and budget editor at CQ Roll Call, for joining me.
Great to see you again, David. Thanks a lot.
And we'll be back next time.